Guys, on behalf of Lisa Leff and myself, I want to welcome you to the culminating event of this 63rd annual conference of the Society for French Historical Studies. And now that it's almost over, I think I speak for the both of us when I say that we are truly delighted and gratified to have been given the opportunity to host this conference and to bring together such an interesting and engaging, and perhaps most importantly for us, over the past 2 days, warm and caring group of scholars. So thank you to all of you for making this a successful event. It gives me great pleasure tonight to introduce our speaker for this banquet, Sophia Rosenfeld, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. I've known Sophie for many years, since we overlapped in graduate school, and I've been a great admirer as I watched her career unfold over the last number of years. Her career is sort of, I think, even at this early stage, is uniquely marked by a desire to get both deeper and more broadly and more deeper and broader questions are asked in every successive book and essay that she writes. Her first book was called A Revolution in Language, The Problems of Signs in Late 18th Century France, and that was the starting point of an intellectual journey that would become more impressive with each succeeding publication. Her second book was the very well-received and prize-winning Common Sense, A Political History, which explored the concept of common sense across multiple countries and continents. Her current project, out of which this talk emerges, looks at how the idea and practice of choice-making became central to the modern conception of freedom. In addition to her books, Sophie has published in the AHR, the JMH, French Historical Studies, of course, and the William and Mary Quarterly, as well as essays in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Dissent, and The Nation. She speaks to us today on the topic of A Tale of Two Texts, or Why Write French History Today? Please join me in welcoming Sophia Rosenfeld.
Let's see, a little logistics first here. Too many parts here. Let's see. Well, let me begin by saying an enormous thank you to Lisa Leff and Katrin Schulteis for this invitation, for that very, very nice introduction, and for really a very terrific conference. This has been an exceptionally good meeting of the French Historical Studies, so thank you both. And let me also say a thank you to all of you for being here. It's not always one gets to speak to a crowd that has so many people in it that one thinks of as, in many cases, mentors and just people I admire tremendously. So thank you for persevering till 8:30 on the final night of the meeting. Okay. Tonight, I offer you, as promised, a tale of two texts. But I'm going to start with a warning. Neither text contains anything like an explicit narrative, Dickensian or otherwise, in its pages, and I do not have a wonderful story to recount for you about stumbling upon either of these texts in an unknown archive in Toulouse or in a garage sale in Tulsa or anything else of the sort. The tail part of this talk is my own construction, and the documents in question are ultimately both but bit players in what's largely a speculative story. But I think for the historian interested in the here and now, which I would describe myself as, the story is rather important. And specifically, I'm proposing to use two rather obscure French texts, one 18th century, one 19th century, to sketch the outlines of a story about how ideologies are made, focusing for this purpose on an ideology that I think underlines a lot of modern life, from kind of consumer capitalism to human rights ideals. And in the end, I want also to make a case for why France, in its long history, why France provides what I think of as especially fertile ground for studying such questions. So that's the preliminaries. Now let me tell you a little bit about the two texts. One of them's already up here. The first is a handwritten, all caps sign, not in my writing of it, but it should be, displaying a formule de serment, or compulsory oath of just 36 words that was composed and agreed upon by the Committee of the Constitution in May 1790. According to the Archives Parlementaires, the committee determined on this occasion that identical copies of this sign would henceforth be placed next to ballot boxes all across France, anywhere where voting was going to take place, and anyone who was going to vote would have to come up, say, je le jour, and proceed to put something, it's not clear what kind of ballot, into a box. I will read you a version in English. You can read it in French on the screen. You swear and promise to name only those who you have chosen in your soul and conscience as the most worthy of public confidence without being swayed by gifts, promises, solicitations, or threats. That's it. Okay. Now the second text. We'll just... There. Okay. It's a little different. This is definitely a different beast. This one comes from a small book printed in 1847 and again in 1849 by the Parisian Polish dancing instructor Solarius, who went by one name, you know, sort of like Madonna or something. Anybody ever read Solarius? Okay, good. That's lucky. Who is famous for bringing the polka from Bohemia to Paris. Most of the 100 pages of La Danse des Salons are filled with very detailed descriptions of all the most fashionable dances of the moment, from the quadrille to the mazurka. And here's a typical passage describing a particular cotillon dance that I'll come to in a moment called Les Chaises. And you can read it. It's not terribly fascinating, but it reads something like this. The English version goes something like, the conductor or master of ceremonies sets out and makes his partner sit down in a chair placed in the center of the room. He then takes two gentlemen and presents them to the lady, who must choose one of them. He then makes the rejected gentleman sit down and presents two ladies to him that he may select one. The first gentleman retains the rejected lady and conducts her to her place in dancing or waltzing. This figure may be performed for one, two, three, or four couples. There's a lot more like this, you get the idea. So, neither is in fact obviously a great text in the sense of having major literary or historical significance. The two texts also differ, obviously, in material form, in genre, in relationship to authorship, intended audience, dates, and most obviously subject matter. That's one reason I chose them, just that they were... didn't, on the surface of it, have that much to do with each other. But to a historian's eye, they do contain certain shared characteristics. Both have an instructional quality, a kind of how-to ethos. They're both meant to be put to use, performing some kind of action that's individualized and also fully public, as well as reproducible in multiple venues. And despite, or really as a result of this orientation towards practice, both take us to the heart of the question, what is one doing when one makes a choice? The first on voting answers mainly by talking about a mental process, about how one picks something. The second is about logistics and bodily navigation. But read together as historic documents, they start to reveal something about how we, and I'm using we here to really mean people today in many parts of the world, have become habituated to what's really a rather historically anomalous position, now central to human rights laws and ethics, that to have and to make choices in multiple domains is precisely what it is to be free. I think of this as a kind of very modern understanding of that. And so with this kind of truism in mind, I want to go back to both texts and look at them a little bit more closely. Okay. Here we go. The first, our sign, you will notice, introduces a variant of the word choisi, at the start. Importantly, it does so in connection with elections, a newly critical feature of French political life after 1789, insofar as the act of voting, especially for representatives, was widely seen as essential to the idea of implementing popular sovereignty or self-rule. This is pretty self-evident. In the case of our instructional poster, there's also the suggestion that making a choice is an active process. It depends first on having interior convictions, in one's soul and conscience, and then actualizing them as outward commitments in some public ritual, first the swearing and then the depositing of some sort of vote, with an understanding that this process, if performed by the people en masse in a specially demarcated setting, will have some kind of positive effect in and on the world. So voting is here envisioned as the instantiation of the people's commitment not only to an original social contract, but to making their own choices in the world of political representation on a semi-regular basis. Okay, so far so good. That wasn't too surprising. But what's striking from our position, I think, is all that's left out and even forbidden here in the text of this oath, and which we know was largely, in our very modern sense, missing from voting in the late 18th century, from, we know, thanks to the work of people like Malcolm Crook and Philippe Tanchot and Olivier Christin and other scholars of voting. Most obviously, while voters are informed that they will have to make a choice about personnel, and they must choose the best of the options before them, the most worthy of public confidence, they are told neither how or where to find these options, or what criteria to use in constructing a list of the worthy. Successive revolutionary assemblies deliberately balked at providing voters with a formal slate of candidates from which to make selections, leaving the possibilities essentially limitless. And this is an amazing idea, that you basically could vote for anyone, so the possibilities were as many people as, you know, basically were eligible to be electors. Moreover, we see that anything like campaigning or soliciting votes, and not just vote buying or intimidation, was strictly prohibited by revolutionary law, meaning that it was not possible for candidates to signal to those doing the choosing either that they wanted to be chosen, or in an age before parties, that they embodied any substantive differences, personal or political, from anyone else. Choices introduced here without, to use modern jargon, you'd say something like without a choice set or menu of options, and without any ceding to what would be called preferences, things that we think of in modern terms as sort of essential to voting or to choice in general. Moreover, this oath means voters have to swear basically to an absence, to not having done something, rather than specifically to having done something. Because even if you were able to make up your mind and figure out from your convictions what would be the right answer in some way, who to vote for, there's nothing here about the manner by which you would externalize those sentiments or how it'll actually take place. And if you read the Archives Parlementaires, you'll see that there's not much discussion of things you might think would be there. How do you mark the ballots? Is this process public or private? Is it secret? Is there a list afterwards of how you voted or not? The procedure is, in a sense, not worked out. So in the same way we often concentrate, I think, on thinking about who could vote, always about questions of eligibility, which, in a sense, wasn't largely worked out in the beginning either, except for the idea that male heads of households with some property would likely be the voters. The procedure is even less worked out, and very few revolutionaries, with the exception of Condorcet, really have much to say on the subject either. So it seems to me that if you can read this even further, you might say the very fact of needing an oath tells us something about the intended worries around implementing this notion of choice. In the first instance, they were largely about the possibility that all this choice-making would exacerbate division, make for conflict, in a situation in which an election really was supposed to produce something like unanimity, a people or nation who spoke with one voice. And increasingly and lastingly, anxieties swirled around the chance that voters would allow private, individualized tastes, or something like preferences or self-interest, to impinge on a process that was supposed to be about determining the public good. So our oath is supposed to provide a kind of active check on both possibilities. But in truth, it's only a small step process-wise in this direction, and that's the point. Despite the loose connection that we start to see emerging in this kind of text between something like self-rule or liberty and choice, it took a long time, more than an additional century, in what might be called, I would think, a second democratic revolution, before the idea that's so essential to human rights ideals now, the idea that freedom requires a process that allows for individuated and confidential expression of personal preferences from a set menu of options without any of those things being really in play here, It took another century before that was either a French or a global norm. And I wouldn't say that it was a natural outgrowth of 1789. I wouldn't say that it was preordained, or that we can draw really any straight lines here. In the course of the long 19th century, what really happened was a lot of endless kind of tampering with how voting was going to take place. And kind of tinkering is really the word I mean here. And this happened partly as a result of ongoing legislative debates, but a lot of it just happened in the doing, in the fact that elections kept on happening repeatedly. In fact, and this is where I'm going to sort of shift here, in fact, politics was not the only realm in which 19th century French people were called upon to make selections or choices on a regular basis. The 19th century saw numerous other experiments in the institutionalization of forms and types of choice making, from choice in commerce to choice in courtship and marriage. Those of you who've read Suzanne de Son, for instance, will know that she talks about a lot of really interesting strategies as marriage laws change to try to figure out, you know, should there be marriage bureaus where you go to, you know, figure out who your spouse is going to be? Should people put ads in the newspaper? How is all this going to be negotiated? And most of these don't go any further, but you can see the sort of wrestling with how to make these processes work. And our second document, the Dance Manual, says little comparatively about choice as a concept. And it says nothing about interior convictions of any kind, even preferences for some dancing partners over others, though it tells you to be sure, if you have any, not to express them. But as evident in the passage I read earlier, 19th century social dances were often focused on the business of choosing, in this case, partners, not representatives, partners who might be potential suitors down the line. And indirectly, alongside discussions of rhythm and foot placement, Salarius's Danse des Salons is all about the performance of choice, or more specifically, about a kind of complex and explicitly gender-differentiated choice-making etiquette that would be required in order for social life to allow for this increasing idea of experiencing something like freedom of choice, but without devolving into lawlessness or social strife. So the years 1847-9, we associate mainly with a second major wave of political revolutions, as well as the rise of universal male suffrage. But this moment also marks, as some of you surely know, the height of the craze for balls. There's every kind of ball in these years. There's society affairs in great houses. There are association balls, charity balls, diplomatic balls, and big commercial public balls in which basically your ability to pay for a ticket determines the clientele much more than the original guest list. And all this dancing is, of course, a product, I could say, of all sorts of big structural shifts, just like the questions about marriage, just like the questions about voting. One could look at how marriage becomes both contractual and sentimental in new ways. One could look at the rise of new kinds of urban entertainments in an increasingly commercial environment. One could look at changing class formations that make balls important. But you could also say that the rage for balls, or what's known as la dansomanie of the 1840s, was also an effect of the first closed couple dances becoming socially acceptable in France. By closed couple, I mean somebody facing you directly. Early in the 19th century, the quadrille, or the contredanse, still held sway in most social settings. What distinguished these kind of traditional dances was their collective ethos, the fact that they were danced by groups of couples, often organized with social hierarchy in mind. Think about who gets to go first in a minuet, you'll have an idea. And following established patterns that required not much physical intimacy, but lots of changes of partners within dances. One version required so much swapping in the 1830s that it was known as la sans-simonienne, which tells you a little bit about closely how dance patterns were associated with marital and social arrangements. Well, all that began to change gradually in the aftermath of the Congress of Vienna with the arrival in Parisian high society of the waltz, in which a couple stayed together exclusively for the duration of the dance, facing one another in a kind of embrace, turning steadily both as a couple and in a giant kind of counterclockwise circle around the room, largely unmoored from the group as a whole. The waltz and variants of it, other close couple dances like the for people who are really interested in this kind of thing, the galop, the polka, and the mazurka, all of which I think historians have largely neglected, though dance historians haven't, had two great effects on 19th century social life, and cities especially. They introduced what was sometimes called the charms of liberty into the public realm, which meant really the possibility of a kind of intimate, almost daringly physical, even sexual behavior among what were often strangers or mere acquaintances that would have been taboo in any other setting. So it's this very strange sort of space outside of space. And simultaneously, they unleashed their own set of anxieties, especially around the fraught business of choosing. For as any reader of 19th century novels know, from La Comédie Humaine to Madame Bovary, choosing properly with whom to have all of this consensual bodily contact could potentially lead, successfully, to marriage, a prize that, ironically, in a sense, requires one to give up subsequent choice or liberty in the domestic sphere, but navigated incorrectly, choice in partners led to thwarted ambition, humiliation, heartbreak, ruin, or once again, social discord. And if you really think about the centrality of balls in 19th century novels, you'll start to see how really significant these moments are. The solution was ever-increasing public vigilance, not only about performing the steps correctly, but also about avoiding any kind of indecorous behavior along the way. And I should add, this wasn't true just in France. Books like this, like La Danse des Salons, was exported. You can find it in New York or Philadelphia. In an English translation, you can find it in London. And French dancing masters were in demand everywhere. Basically, these rules were taught widely all the way through the 19th century. So what starts in Paris doesn't stay there. The difference from the voting case is that the regulation of behavior in the ballroom... Does that sound... Oh, dear. The difference from the voting case is that the regulation of behavior in the ballroom, as in courtship in general, depended largely on community standards or what we might call social norms, not formal laws, though public balls certainly had a heavy police presence because sometimes fistfights did break out over choice of partner. Salarius doesn't actually go over the basic rules of ballroom comportment. He doesn't tell us, as most dancing masters do in these 19th century guidebooks, and as readers of Jane Austen surely know, that the man must always ask the lady to dance, and never the other way around, whether in public or private, that she has the power of refusal on account of needing rest, but must not then choose to dance with somebody else until later in the evening, that no man can occupy any woman for more than 3 dances in an evening, that he must escort her to her seat after each dance, her left hand in his right without delay or small talk, and a bow at the end, that women should keep track of who's chosen them and for which dance, often by having a little dance card that you hang from your skirt with a kind of pin so you could write down who picked you for which moments, and that any displays of personal preference or staring should have no place in any of this. Salarius leaves such rules unstated, not because they haven't been formulated yet, but rather to compliment his readers by suggesting that such rules are by now too well known for people like them to require that they be stated once again. From high society events to servants' balls, the rules of the dance floor were encouraged, enforced, and ultimately meant to be sort of internalized, much like the form of dances themselves, by men and women alike. But our author adds something else of interest to the historian of choice, as well as dance. After he finishes going over all the basic dances of Parisian high society at mid-century, he gets to a final section called the so-called cotillon, a new fad of the 1840s, built around the waltz that are best described as a series of dance games with props to be played at the end of a ball in a private house. He describes 83 possible variations or figures. Late in the century, some dancing masters list more than 100. To us, they seem shockingly silly. One involves men chasing women around the ballroom with butterfly nets. I thought that was particularly odd. One involves getting the opposite sex to try to eat biscuits off the end of fishing rods as the prelude to a gallop. My earlier example up here sounds a lot to me like a game you play at very small children's birthday parties with chairs, But they turn out, much like our oath, to be all about the business of picking, this process. choosing functions in these odd dance games, not as a precursor to the real action, not before you get on the dance floor, it's the focus of the dance games themselves. A good number of Stellarius's cotillon variations, not surprisingly, involve men doing the choosing from among the assembled women, much as all the major 19th century ballroom dances do. And for this reason, you know, critics who thought this was really a debauched space would often compare a ballroom to an Oriental bazaar, meaning really that, you know, the women were there for the picking. Some variations seem to have even turned on humiliating the gentleman's potential female partners. Insofar, these games involved the public rejection of some of the human options put before them as part of the fun and performance. Solaris describes one, for example, it's actually called Les Dames Trompées, in which the main gentleman, quote, approaches several ladies pretending to invite them to dance. The moment the lady rises to accept his offer, he turns away quickly to address himself to another, with whom he plays the same game until he's finally ready to make a choice, unquote. But don't despair. But significantly, I thought this I find very interesting, but significantly, a good number of the games described by Solarius involve role reversal, women picking men, and explicitly leaving some men out in the cold, an activity that I can't think of had really any other counterpart in an era before female suffrage. I'm going to describe to you two figures that, even though the men initiate the activity or construct what we would call the choice set, they fit this seemingly sort of subversive mold, and I can't resist reading you two of them quickly. One is called The Cushion. Solarius tells us, quote, "The first gentleman sets out holding a cushion in his left hand. He makes the round of the room and leaves the cushion to his partner, which she must present to several gentlemen, inviting them to kneel upon it. The lady should draw back quickly from the gentleman she means to mock and let it fall before the one she intends to choose." So you can see this sort of pulling out, it's like pulling the chair out from under somebody. Then there's number 47, the fan, done with a waltz or polka step. Three chairs are placed in the middle of the room upon the same line. The two at the end should be turned counterwise to the center. The first couple sets out waltzing. The gentleman seats his lady upon the center chair and seeks two other gentlemen whom he places in two other chairs. So now you have sort of an uneven number of people. The lady offers her fan to one of the gentlemen at her side and waltzes with the other. The gentleman with the fan must follow the waltzing couple, fanning them and hopping about the circle. Okay. To get more serious. Solarius leaves us to draw our own conclusions about all this temporary, highly orchestrated, and clearly consensual role reversal, which leads to us as something like a modern-day charivari. This is strictly a how-to manual. But another well-known author on social dancing, Lily Grove, writing in England, where Solarius was also very popular, stated at the end of the century that, quote, "women like the cotillon, for it gives them the rare chance of showing their preferences and of enabling them to pay out now and again the men who, through conceit, neglect, or indolence, have displeased them." And some French writers made similar points about the role reversal and choice-making aided by costuming and masks in the public opera balls of mid-century. Alphonse Karr, the author of Encore les Femmes, of a great title, 1858, noted that, quote, "women in life must wait to be invited to love, just as in the salon they must wait to be invited to dance," unquote. But marked in the special space of the opera ball, wearing a mask, he writes, quote, "they chose before being chosen, chose outside their circle of acquaintances, and spoke for once with unmanned tongues," unquote. And still other variants of the cotillon described by Solarius play with decision-making alternatives in different ways, using chance to get rid of the obligation to pick for men and women, using combinations of choice and chance, games like the mysterious sheet or the blind man's buff that involved picking with impaired vision, so that in a sense you didn't have full information to know what you were picking, or using a master of ceremonies to do the selecting and creating new couples out of the crowd, though one imagines a kind of a word in his ear ahead of time might have steered things your direction. The important point is that all of these games introduced men and women alike to a kind of freedom from the normal constraints on the expression, verbal or physical, of sentimental or erotic choice. That was clearly their intended purpose, along with some relief from the need to choose at all in some of the cases. But far from authorizing a free-for-all, cotillons made choice a matter of ever more elaborate rules, props, and procedures. In fact, they subjected choice to formal, stylized, repetitive choreography, as did finally the modern election by secret ballot orchestrated by political parties. That combination of kind of license on the one hand and strict regulation on the other must have been part of their appeal. The dancing of cotillons, silly as they sound, only faded from popularity just before World War I, right about when the isoloir, or voting booth, was introduced across the nation, solidifying the basic format to this day of French elections, but also reshaping modern notions of freedom and choice once again. And I'll show you two images here. Here's the only illustration in Solarius of the cotillon. It's unclear exactly what's happening here, but it appears to be something to do with an ask of some sort. And to give you a completely different image here, here's postcards from 1913, which I find extraordinary because what they depict is so banal in a way. It's people for the first time voting with a secret ballot, which is to say in kind of cabine or isoloir, but obviously important enough to have been memorialized in a form of postcards. There are a large series of these. And again, you see a kind of choreographed procedure of people engaging in some kind of choice-making activity. But does it make any sense to try to connect these two texts, or for that matter, the two images I just put up, one embedded in the history of voting and the other embedded in the history of waltzing or social dancing? Do we actually have a story here or anything more than a thematic or semantic coincidence? Well, here comes the speculative part. My argument is that these two documents are but minor players, nodes, really, in a larger story that to this day remains hidden, largely from view. We don't swear oaths before voting anymore. We certainly don't dance the cotillon. Two activities that, in a sense, our two texts helped concretize, both as material objects that were useful in the performance of those activities and by, in a sense, theorizing what they were about. So I'm talking, in a sense, about two obsolete activities here. But our democratic political imaginary was shaped in the past, I think, by both kinds of activities. And many other ordinary experiences of choice-making and practice, complete with their own rules and constraints, as well as, or even more than, statements of philosophic principle. Today, of course, we engage in choice-making activities all the time, without much consideration. All of us at some point picked whether we wanted chicken, fish, or vegetarian options off a literal menu, for instance. And we're very used to picking. We pick partners and representatives, employees, students. We pick people all the time. We do this online. We do this in person. Choice making is for us an ordinary activity. Moreover, both having ever more opportunities for choice making and expanding the range of choices before us are celebrated as goals across the political spectrum, especially in the United States, when you could think about, for instance, reproductive choice on the left. Sorry, wrong hand. Reproductive choice on the left, but a kind of mirrored element of school choice, healthcare choice has been part of the rhetoric of the new administration just in the last few weeks. Across much of the globe, including France, an attachment to choice and an association of it with sort of a default association of it with France have come to be critical not just to advertising and consumer culture, but also to democracy promotion. Indeed, if I were going to add a third text to this, it might well be the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was crafted by an international team, albeit one with a heavy French bias, in the immediate aftermath of World War II. For in this text, we find a concrete link between freely chosen representatives in the political sphere, a right to enter into marriage with the full and free consent of intending spouses in private life. There's also mention of free choice of employment and, quote, freedom to have whatever belief of his choice, unquote, all described as rights so essential to human well-being that the laws protecting them should transcend the laws of specific states. Subsequent late 20th century human rights texts have only expanded the association of rights with choice, something you really don't find in the 18th century in the same way. Of course, upon reflection, if you stop for a minute, you start to think these are odd categories to put together. the choices enumerated in these texts are of very different types. The rules governing them are certainly different. The way we feel about them is certainly different. But this text has, over the last 70 years, come to kind of encapsulate something like modern common sense, a way of reasoning and talking and viewing the world, now universally accepted, we assume, by all decent people everywhere. Its logic really remains exceptionally powerful. Indeed, though some social scientists have concluded that since the late 20th century, we've actually reached a point of saturation and are almost overwhelmed with choice making as both a practical obligation and an ideal, we still rarely challenge this association between choice and freedom. So as a present-minded historian, albeit one who largely studies the world before the 20th century, I want to know, how did this happen? What I think this talk, or I hope this talk, has begun to show via my oath and my dance manual is that a straight line does not run from the political principles of the French Revolution to widespread acceptance or even lip service to human rights ideals rooted in choice since 1948. A nascent idea of some kind of choice as a path to freedom can be found in 18th century texts in multiple domains, the political actually being one of the later domains, I would argue. But in the 18th century, choice making remained restricted in its field of application, in part because it probably didn't get you very much. There was less to be gained. It was considered mainly a practice to be done by men if it were to be done well, usually had more to do with communities than individuals, and largely functioned without much by way of rules and regulations compared to the present, certainly. It was also a source of anxiety, not least for Kant, who proposed just on the eve of the French Revolution that the discovery of choice both made human history possible and introduced all subsequent mental anguish. Some of us might feel that from time to time still. What happened between the French Revolution and the First World War was that the organization of choice making, the how as much as the what, became a live problem to be enacted or to be worked out in practice as well as theory. And as occasions for choice making, for engaging in choice making behavior grew, but also as the choreography and constraints around this behavior grew, you might think of something like the cotillon as a metaphor for larger social processes, even ordinary people, including women and the poor, by the end of this period, became increasingly habituated to choice-making as a part of life. And arguably, individual choice-making came to seem more vital to shaping a life. Ironically, in other words, between the 18th and 20th centuries, as choice-making became both more rule-bound and more routine, it became increasingly associated with this new feeling of being, or even feeling, free. The story that I've just told, this speculative story, I think has the virtue of giving us also some kind of glimpse into how an ideology or a doxa, by which I mean a system of thought that's so dominant that it comes to structure and undergird even our most contentious arguments, but avoids detection or even discussion itself, how that comes into being. And the answer has to do with the mutually constitutive nature of thinking, talking, and finally doing. Here in the example of the association of choice and freedom, we see language, the desire to link the concept and term choice with self-rule, setting in motion and shaping subsequent bodily practices and associated mental habits. But we also see subsequent social practices and psychological patterns with all the constraints around them and all their growing banality, reshaping ways of talking about and ultimately conceiving of choice. So the cotillon is here just one example, and a small one at that. But I want to suggest that it shows us something about how meaning gets internalized only as it's sort of incarnated in all kinds of, or embodied in all sorts of practices that then in turn experientially produce the possibility of new kinds of meaning. This is how, I would argue, ideology as opposed to philosophy is made. Okay, so finally, in the few minutes left to me, why France? And I should add that generally as a historian, I don't look at France in isolation, but I continue to be drawn to thinking about France. And I think it's worth asking, you know, what draws us, especially North Americans, to spend so much time thinking and writing about the French past? And I clearly can't speak for others, but I don't think that Francophilia answers the question. It just rephrases it in a sense. My own answer is twofold. First, and more obviously, living in a culture here that was transformed in the wake of a social and political revolution in the late 18th century as well, France feels both very close and very far from our own experience. The questions that have preoccupied modern French political and social life are largely familiar to North Americans still. The kinds of things we've been talking about for the last 2 days, from the separation of church and state, or the making of race, or the worth of the poor, or even the value of choice, these are the kinds of things that are recognizable as topics of concern in both contexts. But when we look at these questions backward through time, but also across an ocean and often across a linguistic divide, we also see difference in the formulation of the question and in the response. And that difference helps us, I think, reflect back on our own norms and see them in unfamiliar, defamiliarized, I might say, ways. The history of France gives us, to use Pierre Cernat's phrase, a laboratory for thinking about the key questions around modern life in a democratic republic, but also, I think, for disaggregating pairings like freedom and choice that we might otherwise take for granted. So I see this as a kind of, French history has a kind of instrumental quality in the way I'm presenting it, which you may or may not agree with. But the second answer as to why France has to do with the richness, variety, and nature of the sources available to the French historian. And that brings us full circle back to my story of two texts. To think through these big questions, we can, of course, read some of the great works of literature and philosophy in the Western tradition. But we need not read only Corneille, Rousseau, Fanon, de Beauvoir. And if, like me, you're really interested not just in ideas that were cutting edge in their moment, but equally, if not more, in the informal systems of belief that penetrated multiple social ranks and solidified into something more like doxa, you can always turn to different kinds of French sources. Sources that might seem a bit recalcitrant, actually, like the writings of a Polish transplant dancing master, or a collectively composed revolutionary poster, or even non-linguistic sources like my postcards, but sources where abstract concerns collide with quotidian matters. In a recent book with the audacious title, I would say, How the French Think, anybody seen this? By the British historian Sudhir Hazarvingsa, I'm sorry, I might have said that incorrectly, recently noted that what he calls a long-standing and distinctive French taste for bridging the gap between abstractions and daily life, from imbuing ritual activities with philosophical content to writing philosophical tracts that focus on and even attempt to codify elements of the everyday. He takes this to be a particularly French concern. But perhaps it's not an accident that the so-called history of mentality is a history writing that attempts to dissolve the boundaries between socioeconomic history and intellectual history by studying the collective quotidian thought of ordinary people was in fact a French invention. And for those of us eager to write a kind of intellectual history of the commonplace, even banal underpinnings of modern life and politics, French history has left us extraordinary rich sources, or we might even say resources, across the centuries. So I come at the end of this talk to the unremarkable conclusion that French history is very good, especially in our own troubled times, for thinking with. I don't mean that we should turn to facile parallels between the past and the present. I don't mean it's good for making predictions, certainly not. And you'll be relieved to hear that I don't mean by this that we need to engage in some sort of historical reenactment, we should end our evening with a cotillon or something like that. I certainly don't mean that. Fun as it sounds. But I do think we should take the opportunity to celebrate, or maybe even raise a glass in this late hour, to the pursuit of French history as a